zastupnici, a ne si ugijeniti. I'm sure it was Baha'u'llah about much something. Then we mingled, we scattered. Then they came back with the Gorbachevs. Yeah. We were then told to reoccupy our former positions in the U. Went back to where we were, next to where we was. Yeah. I stood next to the head of the Foreign Office, on my right. Yeah. On my left, and on my left was Peter Ho. And
another legendary figure of our time.
Then she was later, then she remembered all the names. She remembered the names, so I suppose what they learned to do. And when Tchaikovsky's book, Gorbachev, drew up with me, I thought boldly, I said, Ochirad. And the thesis, very happy to meet you. He said, ah, well, you're the one, she said. I've heard a great deal about you. I know all about you. He said, marched on. Then the ambassador followed, he said, remember our conversation about culture. Why haven't you written? So I said, I'm still thinking. Think, he said, continue thinking. So you should do it. When I mentioned his name to the two ladies, they nearly fainted of horror. Yes. The man is a
Zamyatin.
Horror figure, yes. Ambassador. Yes.
He's also very, he looks pale, sinister. Face.
Well, he got this rather white hair and thin, and policeman was. Yeah.
What was your impression of Gorbachev face to face? I mean, just physically.
Not exactly what you'd imagine. Fresh faced, smiling, full of beans. His speech, which I went to, not one, he said nothing at all.
Yeah.
Nor did Mrs. T say anything at all.
Yeah. It was a holding operation, I felt.
Well, I think he's going to talk more seriously. The Germans, it's them he needs.
Yeah.
There, I think he'll do business. Yeah. I mean, I think the Germans can just, he can probably offer them unity or something. He's got something to offer the Germans.
Yes.
Withdrawal of Soviet troops would be a tremendous act, I think.
Yes. Out of East Germany, do you think he'd go that
far? Well, if you want the unification of Germany against us, I doubt the Germans quite want it. But I think he really, it's the weakest link. I mean, there are a lot of Germans that are wonderful and they need to be afraid of Russia will never attack anyone again, much better than England, France, America.
Yeah.
There's a lot of movement, I think.
There's a lot of rubbish in that direction.
I mean, yes, exactly. Certainly. Certainly a lot of rubbish. But it is going on.
Yeah.
Our friend, really, it's not entirely unaffected, but...
Yeah, I know, we've talked about
this. As you expect.
Yeah. Do you have cordial relations?
He was very impressed by the article by Conor Cruz O'Brien in the latest copy of the New York Review, which I haven't read yet, about the Pope.
Yes.
I haven't read it, by saying the Pope could have saved the Jews.
Yeah.
Did you read it?
Yes, I thought it was a rather weak article in some way.
I haven't read it, he was very impressed.
I mean, I think it would be impressive to a German because it does make an important claim, which is that the only conceivable opposition to Hitler
was
Catholic and Christian, I mean, and also coming Lutheran,
exactly.
But particularly...
But if he had really made a point of that, there would have been... I mean, that he did yield Hitler at some point.
Yes.
He stopped doing the killings.
Oh, yes.
The...
Yes, the eugenic side directed at Christian Catholics
was
stopped. Yes.
Because he thought too many members of the army of the party were, in some sense, Catholic.
Yeah.
But troubled.
Yeah.
And so this might also have created some kind of, some sort of disturbance in his quarters that might have saved people.
I think what's facile about that, surely, is that the roots of European anti-Semitism are Catholic, for God's sake. I mean,
I know. And that's why they wouldn't divide it all that much.
Absolutely.
Exactly. The point was, even the Pope had spoken forcibly.
Yes.
It would have had some effect on some of the bishops.
Yeah.
Of course it was Catholic. But what I mean, I didn't mean would de-anti-Semitize them.
Yeah.
And what I mean is that
some
of them would be troubled if the Pope warned them.
Yes.
That they'll go to hell if they did this.
If the Pope had been Wojtyla,
well, I mean,
we'd be in a different situation.
John 23rd, I think.
Yes.
What we really need.
Wonderful man.
For this purpose.
Yes.
Yes. Who met Khrushchev's son-in-law? What is his name?
Adjube.
Adjube. About the trouble.
Yes.
Auftritts. Ja. Von Drew Bay. Also von Drew Bay. Ja, die drauf.
Pravda.
Anyway.
All right.
I tried Bay. I'm coming out with two ladies. Suddenly I realized here they were. Purest Russian intelligence. Unreconstructed
really?
Intelligence.
Yeah.
They could have talked like that in 1890.
Yeah.
It does persist.
What are the characteristics of that form of speech? Unremitting seriousness?
No, they're amusable. They laugh. They like jokes. Not unremitting seriousness.
It's the frame of cultural reference.
Yes, and then moral approach. Moral shock at bad behavior.
Yes.
And the lack of cynicism.
Yes.
Irony, yes, but cynicism not.
Yes.
And.
But you think of yourself as one. I mean, that's your primary cultural allegiance.
I feel comfortable, yes. I feel comfortable talking to these people. And I said to them how very gloomy Plotzenberg's son was. They agreed, and I said, awful not to his wife, was a very, very nice woman. And his daughter said, she has a certain inner coziness.
Yeah.
Inner coziness couldn't have been said by anyone in the West.
Right. Now, what's the Russian for inner coziness?
Внутренняя уютность.
Внутренняя
is inner.
Yes, I know.
Уют
that.
Is comfort.
Уют.
Уют. Уютность.
Уют.
Is coziness. Уютный человек. Cozy man.
Why is the word, you use the word cozy very often as a value of yours. I wonder why it is so important to the
because
Russians.
Because of this sort of thing.
Because it's such a comfortless society in lots of ways.
Yeah, I know, but it is uyut, yes. I like the absence of restraint, non-solemnity.
Yes.
I think I hate solemnity very much indeed.
Yes.
That's a quality.
Yes.
I'm trying to say uyut. German, unheimlich, means sinister and unpleasant. Something awful.
Yes.
You can't say heimlich.
Yes.
German for uyut would be... No, bequem is comfortable, that's what it. You know Hegel's definition of liberty. Bei sich selbst sein, to be at home.
Yes.
For the good.
Yes.
No external factors. You're obtrude. That's why when you conquer the world, you'll be alright.
Yes.
So long as anything lingers outside.
I've always felt quite seriously that any association between freedom and home is quite sinister, in fact. It's a sinister definition of freedom to me. Would that be that as a
why? Explain why.
Well, because it then suggests a kind of being unreconciled to being not at home.
Oh, yes.
Then implies a kind of
when
it's associated with a certain kind of volkishness, you know, a certain kind of, you know, I can only be at home among my own. I can only be free among my own.
My own world is what you do.
You know, it then gets unpleasant to me.
Yes, the definition of freedom is when, well, that's what my colleague, I think I told you, Plamenets, said to me, who was a Yugoslav, Montenegrin.
Yes.
He said, solitude doesn't mean being alone, not having anybody else in the room. Being alone. It means that nobody understands what you're saying.
Yes.
That's what solitude is.
Exactly.
You see?
Absolutely.
And therefore, the opposite is when everything is intelligible.
Yes.
When you speak a language which they understand, I mean, communication is about.
Yes.
Easy communication,
yes.
Natural communication, without analysis.
Yes.
That's the kind of thing, but I agree.
Do you have any memory in your mind, now it's so long ago and you're so at home here, of when you suddenly thought, aha, I no longer think in Russian, I no longer feel in Russian, I am now, bingo, we're here, we're home.
No such memory occurred. I'm very unselfconscious, by nature. Therefore it happened, but there wasn't a moment which I was aware of suddenly this change of getting good. Now I think in English. Now I'm at home, now I'm with them, I'm integrated.
But perhaps that's to say you don't entirely think in English.
Yes, I do.
You do.
But that's on my deathbed. If I had to say something rather spontaneously, I might suddenly erupt into Russian. But it's not likely, I think.
Yeah. As my uncle did as he lay dying last month, he suddenly...
He's dead.
He just died recently. He just
took Russian.
After being in the kind of lost world of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's and God knows what afflictions of the aged, and not saying anything in any language, suddenly on his deathbed began to speak
Russian.
Russian.
My mother spoke German.
on her death.
Surprised me, yes. Surprised me.
What would you have expected to speak?
It was either Russian, or even Yiddish, I suppose, which must be the language of her childhood. But she spoke pure German. She went to German school in Riga. Pure, she could speak middle class, old-fashioned German.
Yeah. And could you make out what she said?
I could make out what she said, yes. And then very notable. But it was pure, very Riga German, very clearly enunciated Northern German. Surprising to me. I didn't know, I mean, she didn't talk it. Otherwise, I mean, she did to her maid, who was a German. From Mecklenburg. You see, but otherwise she never had an occasion of talking it. So when she had a stroke, you see. And after the stroke she got to fell into second childhood, and she became very jolly, happy. And like when I used to come see her, she was extremely affectionate, delighted to see me, and began telling me stories about who'd seen her lately. All of which we imagined. Man had come with a long beard and read her story by Charles. No man with a long beard read anything. I mean, everything was entirely, it was quite true. It was a second, real second childhood. Yeah. A lot of daydreams.
Was she affected? I mean, was her...
No.
Some strokes give her paralysis?
No. She took her very clearly. Mm. She was found on by a maid on the floor. She fell out of bed. Mm. Nothing happened. She just stayed there.
How long did this period extend?
This period was about 2 years. Then she became a vegetable. Mm. She gradually became silent. And then the look of unhappiness spread over her face. She didn't speak at all. No sounds. Immediate.
And then at the very end she spoke.
No. The German was before the final phase. Yeah. During the cheerful phase. Yeah. When she suddenly woke up to sleep and then suddenly began talking in German. Even it was. Yeah. No, it wasn't at all.
When did she die?
She died in, I think exactly in, '73. She was 74. She was 93 about. Yeah. 93 and a half. Well over 90.
And she'd survived her husband by?
By 23 years.
What were those years like? Was she lonesome?
Yeah. She certainly was. And every time I came to see her, she was very pleased. Every time I left, she could hardly bear it. Mm-hmm. And I used to hate it because she would accompany to the gate of the house, I mean, little front garden. Yeah. You see, to the gate of the house, and while I sort of walked away.
Yeah.
I took a car, whatever it might be. I sort of walked away, you see. She stood there, picture of and abandonment, and nostalgia. Looked at me with sad eyes, the form of blackmail.
And did you feel resentment occasionally?
On my part. Yeah. I felt I was being blackmailed. She wasn't resentful.
Yeah.
She was terribly sad. She didn't want to go. Didn't beg me to stay because she thought she wasn't. But every time I went, tears into her eyes were awful.
Do you always speak Russian of it?
No. I talk English to her.
Always?
Always. Except when I used to lose my temper. And suddenly I would cross to Russian. She would say, no, go and talk English. None of that. None of that.
Why do you think you crossed into Russian and you got angry?
I think because it's somehow a language I thought it should understand better, somehow it's more directly offensive. More directly aggressive.
Yeah.
I didn't do it very often. The only people one can lose one's temper with might be one's nearest. That's certainly true.
Yeah.
I've done it with Aline.
Yeah.
Nobody else.
Yeah. What happens when you lose your temper?
I don't ramp about the room. I start shouting, I think. I start shouting, I think. I can't go on. Start shouting.
That's you blow things over quickly?
Yes, I do. Very much more difficult to cure the wounds which my explosions cause. That doesn't blow over quickly.
Do you bear grudges?
No. By nature, not. Very few grudges I've had to bear. I don't know that I've often been offended. I'm so accommodating, not so much at home, everywhere else. That's my trouble. I mean, I'm, by nature, adapt myself a little too easily, perhaps.
Was seeing your mother, getting back to your mother, a duty or a pleasure or a combination of both, or what was
duty,
it like?
Duty. Duty. I mean, I was very obviously attached to her. And when she was in a good mood, I've had a very good time with her, of course, because she was full of temperament and spirit. She was anything flat, anything but dull. She was not so puritanical either. And she was full of wit. But she was a fearful bully by nature, very obstinate. Wanted to have things the right way. And escape from my parents' house to Oxford was great liberation, 1938. I felt happy and wonderful on my own. My father never oppressed me in any way.
But your mom did.
Very strongly. And him too. The bullying was.
What form did the bullying take?
Well, we were not just telling what to do.
Can you recreate a scene?
I'm just trying to think. Well, it used to annoy me. Scene, no. But it used to annoy me when she came to my room in the morning. I was allowed to sleep as late as I wanted, it was a mistake. And I was given breakfast in bed. And as it am always. The sheep used to bring it. Sometimes the maid did. And then she would settle down and say, what is the plan for the day? I did not have a plan for the day. I believe in spontaneous. Maybe I didn't want any specific arrangements, so I'd have having some frightful sort of straitjackets of that kind. Yeah. But it's really taking front. I say, there's no plan. We do what I like. Oh, I should look. Not silly, I'm saying, it must be something that wasn't what you want to do. Conquer stuff. So, then, what else? I used to become irritated by her meanness, by economy of money, constant saving of money, collecting pennies, collecting candle ends. I see what I mean, that was wrong. My father tended to be spendthrift. He was convinced that unless she extracted a lot of money from him, she didn't spend, one day we'd be bankrupt, and she alone would be able to keep us going. You see?
Did you find large sort of stashes of things in her house?
She had no friends, really. I mean, people admired her, used to come and see her, and she told them how to live. But there was no intimate. I'm sure she was no equal, no intimate. I think she would pour herself out there.
Did you pour yourself out to her in later life?
No. No, I'm not a pourer out. By nature, not, I think.
But I remember you saying when you were, as it were, courting, I mean, that there was a period in which you went to the south of France with them, for example, that they're in the scene in some of the crucial moments of your life. And I'm wondering whether you talked to them and
they were
worried
there.
With
they
them.
They were always there. Yeah. They were never not there. Yeah. All they existed for is each other and me. Hmm. So the most closely tied trio that ever existed. And since they had no other friends and no other concerns.
Yeah.
They never loved each other or thought of it. My mother wasn't in any degree in love with my father. From the beginning, I suspect. That's why she wanted me to be born. That's something you live for.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, they were together continuously. There's no question of not. In that sense, kind of Victorian marriage of absolutely conventional kind of like peasants.
Yeah.
Who don't think of leaving each other. Whatever they may feel about.
Yeah.
So they are fixed in the hut together, so to speak, around the fire.
But during there were some periods of misery connected with your courtship of Arlene and your love
Arlene,
life.
No. Yeah, there were periods of misery for me, but they knew nothing of it. Mm. I certainly confessed nothing. Mm. My father didn't see how I could possibly. I mean, I wasn't yet. I hadn't proposed to Arlene, certainly. Before my mother died, that he saw that I was also keen on her, as you might say. She said, how can you? You are thinking of marriage, he said. Marriage, a woman with three children? It's absurd.
That's what he said.
Yes. You see, my God, marriage and with three children. They have all this huge bed.
Yeah.
And all this other thing.
Yeah.
You really think, no.
Yeah.
My mother, on the other hand, never got on tired of that age. Never totally crazy with her, to use that word. They came from universes which were a little too different from each other. My mother fundamentally would learn middle class. Claudine is anything but. And there's an unbridgeable sort of gap between those two. Still, they were trying to be nice to each other. What pleased my mother was she thought Claudine was in love with me. Decided that. Mm. She informed me. Right. And that was the case. For that, she was prepared to forgive anything.
Yes. Because it was good for you.
No doubt it was good for me. And a proper thing to feel.
What else could they feel?
Most people didn't feel it, but that was mysterious. Difficult to explain. But since she did, this was natural sentiment. Yeah. You see, what else could I inspire?
when you were up at Oxford, it sort of, we're talking now the 50s, the 60s.
So she was a rather liar, my mother.
Really?
She was, yes. Sometimes she used to conceal things. Mm. Or try and make out the things weren't what they were, in order to get me to do something. And I would say, that's not true. Your mother is a liar, she would say, irritably, all right. Your mother is very common, very vulgar, very ordinary, and a terrible liar, she would say in an unnatural voice.
Yeah.
And so on, you see. And long you, now she lost her temper. Quite easily. Yeah. She was white in the face. And then you could see that something awful was going to happen. She came to say terrible things.
Yeah. And did she?
Yes.
Yes. Hurtful things.
Yes. I can't speak. You ask for what, I can't remember the thing.
Did you visit her once a week or once a month? Or?
Nothing like that. At irregular intervals. Mm. Towards the end, I visited her more often than before. Naturally. Did I visit her once a week? I think the last 5 years of her life I must have done that.
Yeah.
At least once a week. Very boring it was, because came all the way up to Amsterdam, which I knew was terribly bored with the thought of going there. And terribly bored with the thought of seeing her, because I knew it after half an hour, there was nothing to say.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was better than that. But on the whole, it was pure duty. And I'd be ashamed not to do it. And if I could have been liberated from it, I would have been.
You had a kind of dreary tea and kept her company and then would go on.
That sort of thing. That sort of thing. I would be given a cup of coffee or something. Mm-hmm. And then she would tell about her life, what was going on, what she'd seen, what they said. I used to listen patiently.
Yeah.
And then the time would come. I had been an hour or two. That was quite good. I mean, I wasn't exactly unhappy, but I'd been faintly convinced of bored.
Yes.
It was an emotional relationship by then. I mean, it wasn't, mm-hmm. I didn't put my temper, didn't sing and so on. It was just filial. Mm. I was always thought to be a terribly good son, but I was not. My mother fixated, but I never was. Mm. It looked as if I was, because I was constantly concerned about
her. Who said your mother fixated?
People, her friends.
Her friends, then?
Yes. She talked about me, of course, continuously to her friends.
Yes.
Endlessly, and that was a very great bore. They used to say to me, well, your mother told me about you, your mother talked about you last night.
Yes.
So you constantly, mother's always talking about you. I knew it was true, and that annoyed me frightfully. I used to reproach her for that.
Yes.
It really does matter. And you could, why must you? Come on and on and on. It isn't really of interest for all these people.
Yeah.
We must think of neutral subjects to talk about.
But you talked about you because you were also, not only because you were a son, but you were becoming a grand public man.
So. Yes, that was that one of the causes. Mm. Very proud of me, yes.
Yeah.
Nothing like that had ever happened in her family. Yeah. I told you when I became a knight.
No.
Oh, I did. They're not. Well, I was offered a knighthood by Macmillan.
By?
Macmillan.
Yes.
And I got a very curious letter. I got suddenly out of the blue. The year is 1956, mm-hmm. which is when, I think the year I married, I believe. I was married to Aline. I married, I think, in February 56, I would say. About April 56. We'd been to Sicily for our honeymoon and came back. And there was a letter lying for me saying, Dear Isaiah Berlin, which is a curious thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, either make up your mind. Either Mr. Berlin or Berlin or Isaiah or anything you like. Isaiah Berlin means you're not quite sure where you stand for something. I'd met him. Two or three times. Yeah. I mean, very casually. But still, you see what I mean. But there is other. Then there's a formula. It says, I have it in mind to recommend to Her Majesty the Queen that she confer upon you the honor of, and there's a blank. The blank is put in ink. Dukedom. MBE.
Earldom.
Earldom, whatever it might be. CBE, MBE, OBE, Victoria Cross, anything like, you see? And, you see, blank, and said, knighthood. Then it went on, kindly, if you are minded to accept his honor, that very much if you will, you will please, the earliest means right to. The second, my secretary down the street. And, even to him, not writing the secretary. Okay. I did write it. When I got this letter, it plunged into tremendous gloom. Because I thought, well, not for me. I thought, being a knight is not like wearing a paper hat. There's no harm in it, but it's ridiculous. I didn't feel a knight. And I thought my colleagues would be all envious.
Yeah.
And they would wonder why. I hadn't done anything. Yeah. I wasn't a philosopher of the front rank. Yeah. I wasn't, there I was Paul Sowles. I was all right. I've been in the government service during the war, but no, I'm not for all that except, you see. Yeah. Well, I hadn't done, it was years after anyway. I'd stopped being in government service in 1946, and it's now 10 years later.
Yeah.
Certainly as a philosopher, there's no question. They didn't get knighthoods those days. Anyway, much. The Duns didn't get knighthoods much.
Yeah.
I mean, elderly professors who'd served the government. Gilbert Murray must have refused to be a knight. Who were knights amongst us? I can't think of anybody. I mean, Lindemann was a lord because of Churchill. There was an elderly professor of physics of 85 that we got rid of with a knighthood.
Did you get knighted?
Well, that's not very clear. I think because Macmillan rather liked me. That's all.
Right.
Just a tip. Yeah. Just a burst thrown.
A pourboire.
That's all it was, really. You see,
when did you meet him?
Anyhow, I'd met him first in All Souls when he came to stay with Sumner, who was warden of All Souls, who was a contemporary of his burial.
Yeah.
They were friends.
Yeah.
And they served the war and so on.
Yeah.
And they got on quite well. And then he made my acquaintance, said he wanted to meet me, and began talking about my dispatches during the war, which he addressed with pleasure, etc.
Yeah. Is this when he's a minister?
No. He was then in the opposition, I think, under the Labour government, I think.
This is 48, 49.
That's what they did, you see? That was the first time I met him.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went to lunch with Lord Cholmondeley, Marquess of, because Lady Cholmondeley was still alive in 1994. With Harper Rothschild, Harper Sassoon, and she had met me a D with Lady Waverley, whom I knew, and came to, and suddenly developed, I became a fan, and used to come to lectures for him in London. Front row was always this rather stiff lady, Marchioness of Cholmondeley. Sister of Philip Sassoon, who had been a minister.
Yeah.
Well, she gave a party in some enormous house in Kensington Palace Gardens, which they lived, and her husband was the Lord High Chamberlain. Very, very handsome man. Did nothing in his life. Functioned coronations.
Yeah.
Established a prize for calligraphy. Eton, Winchester, and Harrow, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And had women looking after him. He, maybe not sexual, I didn't think so. Thing was that he loved physical fitness. He used to take exercise in the gym, which was the bottom of the house.
Yeah.
And his son, the present Marquess, was entirely interested in toy soldiers and restoring them in battle order. People come and see it now. There is a marvelous country house called Houghton, which belonged to Walpole. Other people after the wonderful objects in it.
Yeah.
Well, she gave a lunch and that was back with him. And he said, whom should I make Regius Professor of History in succession to Poig?
Mm-hmm.
No, succession to Galbraith. And he said, I don't know what to do. I mean, you know, one doesn't want to make a mistake. I had given it a name, I said, but he's 73. And therefore he never reached for anything.
Yeah.
And I mean, he was far the greatest historian of our time, but it was long and coming up to him.
Yeah.
He used to publish him too.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've been all together. All over. Yeah. And then I said, I don't know what I would do. I thought it wasn't for me to recommend anybody. So I said, I think best you could do, Prime Minister, would be to appoint, if you can find her, Catholic, lesbian, communist, Negress. That would get on very well in the great many circles.
And he liked that. He thought that was good.
Liked that very much, yes. So that he would like.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful idea. So yeah. Taylor tried not to talk to her. Taylor thought I would have said him. I was wrong. Make jokes.
Yeah.
Someone reported this to him, you see. I would have said, hey, H.P. Taylor is the only man.
Yeah. And you did not.
What?
You did not because of his relations with Beaverbrook, because of your sense that it...
No, because I didn't think even he deserved it,
yeah.
In fact. Yeah. That's another matter. I mean, he was a very bright and interesting writer, but truth wasn't in him. He wrote down anything he pleased.
Yeah.
No, I think Trevor was wrong about
that.
Yeah. Less nice man, but able historian.
Yeah.
And more truthful, although more accurate, more serious.
Yeah.
Taylor just wrote off the top of his pen, I mean, so to speak, just to annoy people more and so on.
Yeah.
He loved history, knew a great many facts, and was a very good writer.
Yeah.
But fundamentally, the purposes were always polemical.
Yeah.
Rather like Macaulay, if you like. Anyhow, but I mean, it wouldn't have been disastrous if he got it.
Yeah.
The most famous historian writing in England probably that.
Yeah.
But, no, I had no feeling it wasn't that.
So he anyway, consulted you over the religious
second time. Well, in this rather jerky way.
Yeah.
Then I met him, I think, some social occasion. With his secretary, Philip de Zulueta, whom I taught at Oxford, the son of a professor who was very well known, who was very devoted to him, a Catholic, and the secretary sent down his new me and gave a party for him. And for some reason, thought he liked me, and I went to it, and I had long talked to him about everything, and about the war. That was all there. They were in Buen, hence I died there. But then he suddenly offered me this. That's a kind of, I think he just thought it'd be fun to do it.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah.
Well, as I was telling you, I didn't really want it. And I thought, well, shall I not? And rather agonized over it, because I agonized over everything.
Mm.
Over having to make a speech, over having to go into a draw over everything.
Mm.
I'm did look it.
Yeah.
But I agonized and I asked 1,000 people's advice.
Yeah.
When I was offered the did I tell you the orange or Nuffield I was?
Mm.
Did I tell you that?
Yes.
I did tell you.
No, you didn't tell me.
Oh, well, that was all right, I'm going to go back to that in a moment.
Yeah.
You see, I agonized, and I talked. David Cecil said, of course, he was accepted.
Yeah.
And I asked John Sparrow, he said, no, it doesn't suit you at all. It's not, so I mean, all right, but I mean, sir, I said. Then I talked to, and then I gradually became neurotic on the subject. And became neurotic and couldn't make up my mind. And my mother-in-law, who was living at the time, said, I know exactly what you're going to do, you're going to refuse. There's no doubt you won't accept it. It just won't. And I mean, I can see you hate the idea.
Yeah.
Which is up to point true. My dad and my wife, yes. What? I'm talking about my knighthood. I was off now, very worried was, you can corroborate this. Do you remember when I got to neurotic state?
Was there a state about it?
Shall I take it, shall I not?
I'm as bad as
the OM, then. I said to you, what about knighthood? You said you're indifferent. Take it or don't take it, you're right.
Yeah,
either way.
I
that's what you said.
Yeah.
Either way, it didn't
make
a slight difference.
I wasn't dead against. I didn't believe in saying no much.
No, exactly.
But
the yes or no, I don't mind. Do what you like. Do exactly what you please.
Yeah.
It's very unimportant.
My mother didn't get very excited.
My mother, see, your mother said to me, you're going to refuse it. She said, I know what you're going to do. You're going to refuse it. I can see what you're saying. You're going to refuse it. And I say, Sparrow told me not to. David says not to do it. Impolite to refuse.
Well, it became a neurotic subject. It then neurotic. Came to represent
and then
something.
My eyelid began to tremble after that, as a result of this psychosomatic condition, and continued to tremble for a year and a half. I had to go to doctors about it. They said, no, it was all right. It wasn't the brain that was affected. But it did. I mean, I'm not trembling. In a kind of tick.
But doesn't all this add up to you saying you very badly wanted something you thought was faintly ridiculous? And you couldn't resolve the conflict.
I didn't want it at all. But neither did I not want it. I thought it was the opposite.
But isn't that the same thing?
Obviously. But I decided finally not. That I finally made a decision quite easily. I wrote a letter to Macmillan refusing, but didn't send it off. I then went to see my mother, not known to consult her at all.
Yes.
And I said to her, because why shouldn't I? I said, I've been offered a knighthood.
Yes.
She knew what sir meant.
Yes.
Maybe she didn't know that. And she said, she would look frightfully pleased. And she said, how wonderful, etc. And then I said, I'm going to refuse it.
Did you
hear? I did, yes, of course. I was going to refuse it. And she said, there was silence. And she said, you must do exactly what you like. And I mean, I don't know about these things, roughly. You must do what you please. I'm not giving up. But then I suddenly realized, and more or less burst, tears into her eyes.
Oh.
I then knew that if I took it, it would give up pleasure every hour of every day of every month of her life.
Yes.
The old Jewish woman, you see what I mean?
Yes.
Not quite from the ghetto, but I mean,
yes,
from what might be called humble conditions, herself in Riga and all the rest of it. And sir was wonderful. It was so top, you couldn't be better, the Lord was better through.
Yes.
You see, about 10 years. And I could see it would give her intense pleasure. And I thought, no, I can't be. I don't really mind either way. I can't be so selfish.
Yes.
If I refuse, she'll regret it. She'll from time to time tell me why not. And I guess it cause her pain.
Yeah.
Cause a deep, deep regret. I was right about that. Because the pleasure she got from it was infinite. I mean, it continues. From all our friends, all the letters she got, the fact she could address me in letters that I saw, gave her terrific pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I then went back and tore up the letter and accepted it immediately.
When
I tell this story, it sounds like an improbable piece of sentimentality, but it's exactly what happened.
That's what happened. Okay.
Exactly what happened. And then, of course,
the
next thing.
And that
was a nightmare. Even worse.
Well, tell me about that. Tell me about that.
When years passed. Years passed. Years passed. When I was given knighthood, something had to be said about in virtue of what I got it. Usually say political services or literature or philosophy. Nothing about me at all. Blank.
Yeah.
For no reason.
Did your mother come to the investiture?
Yes.
Yes. She did.
Oh, yes.
Certainly did.
No, I did. One of the boys.
One of your boys, yes.
Yeah.
Would have been Philip or Peter. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Peter, my mother certainly came. To working in Palace?
Oh, yes.
Certainly she did.
Yeah.
The second time I got this CBE before that, you see.
Yeah.
That I was informed that in Sweden I was coming back from Leningrad.
Yes.
And I got that entirely for one reason only. Being snubbed by Eden.
At Potsdam or Potsdam.
Not allowed to go to Potsdam.
Right.
Halifax fixed it
right.
As a kind of reward for appalling insult.
Very so denying
it. Absolutely. She said she suggested it.
Yeah, she
did.
It could be for that reason. I know she wasn't married to Eden.
She was not married to Eden in 1946.
Yeah.
Spring. I mean, these things are in 1945.
Yeah.
I think she knew him then.
Yeah.
That would be impossible. I mean, she was just Churchill's niece. She was working in Weidenfeld at best for Corda.
Mm.
I don't think he'd have consulted her.
Yeah, it's possible that she suggested.
Well, the night of she was dead.
Yeah.
Well, tell me about this. When does the COM come up?
Oh, much later.
Oh, like
that was when I was President of Wolfson.
You were in Wolfson,
and
by the 1870s or so.
Before that. I was sitting in the Banbury Road. Woodstock Road.
That's right, yes.
In the second office. Yeah. Not number 15.
47.
Yeah. I was sitting in an office and I was suddenly received a letter from Queen's private secretary, whose name is Adeen.
Hmm.
And he said,
Sir Michael Adeen,
I am instructed by a mentor and so on. Not I have it in mind.
Yeah.
And he wasn't the prime minister.
Yeah.
And she gives it, you see, not
yes.
Not the government.
Yeah.
Prime Minister doesn't recommend.
Oh, really?
Mm. The only one, there are three orders, the Knight of Gotha, they were imposed, they do in fact influence, but they can't say I'm going to suggest. And I think Knight of Thistle, which is the Scottish equivalent. Of, you see, that's the Queen is supposed to do Italian or whatever. And half does do that, in fact. Because the Secretary writes to me occasionally from the, Secretary of the Order, with a pupil of mine many years ago. Yeah. And then if I recommend somebody and they get it, it has happened. I ask him afterwards, did you ask the Prime Minister? He said, no. The Queen likes not to consult. She receives recommendations, but she doesn't consult. Yeah. You see? He's consultable, not consulting. Anyway, I received this letter, and I telephoned Aline in Headington, and I said, disaster has occurred. And you said what?
I don't know, I remember what I said. I realised it was that kind of thing. And I said, well, can't be a PhD, you can refuse that. And then I said, is this a big one?
It's a big one.
I didn't say I'd received a letter from the secretary, I didn't say that.
No,
it was a disaster. You knew that all I could have meant. Not that somebody has died or something dreadful has happened, but I had cancer.
You must have said it was
from. I told her I had cancer, nothing like that. Disaster. And then I came home, and again the question was, then I knew why I didn't give it this time.
Why?
Because I had a great friend called Wheeler Bennett. Wheeler Bennett was very court circles.
Yes.
He was a historical advisor to the Queen, and he was
wrote about
George VI. And he was a very nice man, but dazzled by that sort of Ruritania.
Yes, by Ruritania.
What he liked was beautiful women, I mean spies, brilliant politicians. He was Macmillan's best friend. His literally best friend.
And how did you know Wheeler Bennett?
Because, well, because he was in my office in New York. What I can gain. Thank you. I know what you're doing, but I got, yes, I did. I got into British government service.
Yes, you did.
And Burgess, all that. Yes, well, he was one of the two heads, one of three heads, of the British Immigration Services in 1941.
So nominally your boss in New York?
Certainly was, not very nominally. He was one of three bosses, you see.
And it's Wheeler Bennett who talks to whom to get you? To the Queen?
Well, Wheeler Bennett went after the war. You see, he was an expert in Germany. He was a man who got Brüning out of Germany, saved him from being shot by the Nazis. And he worked in various government departments, particularly intelligence, things like that. And was a very good writer, I think. So in some ways, he wrote good books. And he adored not any royalty, but sort of Ruritanian royalty, I mean ceremonies and mysterious characters and intrigue in Central Europe.
Yeah.
That's in a very amiable, rather sort of in disarming sort of way. But his point was, he was a very nice man, a good character. And snob, yes, but not very.
Yeah.
And kind and generous.
Yes.
And we lived near Oxford by then, in the house which I actually modeled. Once occupied Gossington. We saw him at a certain moment. We were friends. He was very nice about me, this autobiography, which would insult. And I kind of love autobiographies. And Lasky once said to me about who didn't like me, well, they all talk about him. He may occur in people's autobiographies, but nothing of substance will be left. Anyhow, but. And
you've had the last laugh on that one, haven't you?
More or less, yes. Anyway, he once said, we're going to talk with OMs as a class. And he said, you ought to get the OM. He said to me, I said, it's silly. Ridiculous. My conception of OM was geniuses. I mean, Bertrand Russell, yes. Henry Moore, certainly.
Yes.
T.S. Eliot, certainly.
Yes.
Kipling, I think, refused it. Maybe it may not have done. Hardy.
Yeah.
That class of persons.
Yes.
Class politicians who give it to themselves, like Lord George.
Yeah.
Sorry, at least. But you see, not people like me at all. And Governor Murray, yes. Mr. Fisher, yes. Moratium in the States from all the academic and so on, and cultural figures of the first order. Yeah. But then I thought, yeah, then I looked at the list which is applied to the letter. I saw that on it were Lord Zuckerman and Veronica Wedgwood. Then I thought, maybe it wasn't quite so bad. That really would sway me. And then I thought, oh God, Maurice Barra once said more than anything, my great friend, he'll never forgive me.
He would never forgive me.
No, for forgetting it.
Had he been alive.
He was alive.
He was.
He was alive, and he longed for it.
That's why nothing before 17.
No, it was the chance, I think. Yeah. It was exactly what he wanted. And...
like Freddie, he keeps every time he sees him.
What?
Like Freddie, every time...
Freddie is very, very angry at not having it.
Yes.
When Freddie, I got a night with another story. But yeah. Anyway. And, then after a bit, we could say, Adi and I talked about it. We decided on the whole. I again consulted David Sesselink. I was very surprised that I'd been offered it, but affected to be very pleased.
I don't
want to refuse that. Well, I'll tell you, I'll tell you what I have now. Houseman refused. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hey, Houseman, he wrote a marvelous letter, I have to tell you. It's so funny, he sent his letters to the King's secretary in the 20s. Yeah. He said, "Dear sir, I would not be thought wanting in gratitude to His Majesty. It's a very, very high honor. He has been good enough to confer upon me. He wished to confer upon me. But I cannot explain my position better than by quoting the following letter." He then said, "Dear sir, written by some soldier in 1860,
yeah,
who was offered the KCMG or something. Yeah. I would not be thought wanting in gratitude and courtesy to Her Majesty, who wished to confer this very signal upon me, and wish to thank her most deeply in my heart for having had the kindness to think of me in this connection. But to accept it would be for me very unpleasant. Yours sincerely, my dear name is you like J.S. Ferguson." Houseman quoted the whole thing in full and then said, "Yours sincerely, A. Houseman."
Incredible.